Welcome to the podcast, Just But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. About 3 weeks ago, my good friend and colleague, Professor Jennifer Paxton of the Catholic University of America, joined me in discussing St. Thomas Becket's background and his rise from a cleric in the household of Theobald, Archbishop of Canterbury, to be Chancellor of England under King Henry II. Today, I'm fortunate to have Jenny back to complete the story of England's most famous Catholic martyr and saint. Welcome back, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's always fun talking with you about our common interest in English medieval history, and especially about complex people and events such as Thomas Becket and his martyrdom. But before we begin, my husband asked me, wasn't his name Thomas A. Becket? And no, it wasn't. We owe that to a staunch Protestant Tudor writer named Thomas Nash. In 1596, he added the rustic "ah" to lampoon the saint.
Apparently, Nash didn't know that Becket derives from the word for nose, and that he was really Thomas Beaky Nose, which should have been lampooned enough, but Thomas of Becket stuck.
It did. Everybody seems to know of him as Thomas of Becket. Yes. So we left off the last episode with King Henry II appointing his chancellor, Thomas Becket, to replace Thomas's first patron, Archbishop Theobald, in the See of Canterbury.
The 1964 film Becket, which Jenny and I will talk about later in this episode, recreates the moment that King Henry II, played here by Peter O'Toole, has the brilliant idea to appoint his chancellor, Thomas Becket, played by Richard Burton, to be the next Archbishop of Canterbury.
Thomas, extraordinary idea is creeping into my mind. A masterstroke. I'm subtle. I'm even profound. Oh, I'm so profound, it's making my head spin. Are you listening to me, Thomas?
I'm listening, my prince.
We need a new Archbishop of Canterbury.
I think there is a man we can rely on. No matter who it is, once the Archbishop's mitre is on his head, he will no longer be on your side.
If the Archbishop is my man, if Canterbury is for the king, how could his power possibly get in my way?
My lord, we know your bishops. Once enthroned at Canterbury, every one of them will grow dizzy with power.
Not this man. Are you listening to me, Thomas?
Hmm?
You're leaving for England tonight.
On what mission, my prince?
You are going to deliver a letter to all the bishops of England. Mm-hmm. My royal edict, nominating you, Thomas Becket, Primate of England, Archbishop of Canterbury.
My lord, don't do this.
You've an odd way of taking good news. I should think you'll be triumphant.
I'm not even a priest.
You're a deacon. Be ordained priest and consecrated archbishop the next day.
My lord, I beg of you, do not do this.
You've never disappointed me, Thomas. You're the only man I can trust.
I love this scene. I love it when Henry says, Thomas, you have never disappointed me before. And Thomas is thinking, yes, my prince, but I was never Archbishop of Canterbury before. Cinematically, this scene effectively foreshadows the future conflict between the two men and the sense of betrayal that King Henry II would experience when his once loyal chancellor became his adversary as archbishop. It also signals to the movie-going audience that Thomas's inner conflict between his loyalty and friendship for the king and his desire to serve God, and both are real, is going to be resolved in favor of God and the church. The audience has already been keyed to Becket's pangs of conscience, although Henry is completely oblivious to them.
Now, I love the movie Becket, but historians are always spoil sports when it comes to historical movies.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
And I have to point out that as effective theater as this is, it's not history. Theobald died on April 18th, 1161. Becket was elected by the monks of Canterbury to succeed Theobald a year later.
A full year later.
Which is not that atypical. There were often fairly long vacancies in between archbishops, and because of the way that the appointments worked, and the king would get to take the money of the see in between. So he's not elected until May of 1162. And he was ordained a priest on June 2nd. So he was not even actually a priest yet.
No, he was. He was archdeacon of Canterbury, as well as being chancellor. But the problem is, you can't become a bishop unless you're first a priest.
Fortunately, there was no time requirement on how long you had to be a priest.
No, there were a lot of emergency priestly consecrations before people became bishops. I mean, not a lot, but there certainly were some. So he was ordained a priest on June 2nd and consecrated Archbishop of Canterbury by Bishop Henry of Winchester the following day. Now, Henry's decision to nominate Thomas was not a spur-of-the-moment thing. The king was not in a rush to fill the archiepiscopal see. It actually could be kind of fun to have no archbishop for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to worry about a primate.
You could kind of free your hand.
Yeah.
So members of the king's court apparently were notified that Henry intended to appoint Thomas before Thomas knew. Becket's biographer, William Fitzstephen, relates that while Becket was recovering from a serious illness in the hospital of the Church of Saint-Gervais, he was visited by the prior of the Augustinian Abbey at Leicester. The prior, who had come from the king's court, teased Thomas about the way he dressed like a noble. So what he said is, "What's this?" the prior joked. "So you go in for capes with sleeves now, just like fowlers when carrying hawks? And you a clerk. Unique, I know, but plural in your benefices.
Yeah.
Archdeacon of Canterbury, Dean of Hastings, Provost of York, canon here and canon there, custodian of the archbishopric, and, as court rumor has it, archbishop to be." That's the end of the quote. So Becket supposedly responded a lot like he did in the movie by protesting that he knew at least three priests in England whom he would rather see as archbishop. Quote, "For if it should come about that I am promoted, I know the king so well, indeed inside out, that I would either have to lose his favor or, God forbid, neglect my duty to the Almighty." End of quote.
You can never be sure that a story like this is actually true. William Fitzstephen, like Becket's other early biographers, wrote after the archbishop's death. In other words, he wrote with the benefit of hindsight. He knew that Thomas's elevation would bring him into conflict with the king. But that Thomas claimed to know Henry inside out sounds to me like something Becket might well have said. And of all Becket's biographers, William Fitzstephen was best positioned to report court gossip. Before Thomas's elevation to the archbishopric, William had been a royal clerk in the king's chancery, and after Becket's death, he appears to have returned to royal service. He had a foot in both camps. What the movie gets right is Henry II's motivation in choosing Becket. Becket's main qualification, in Henry's eyes at least, was his loyalty and his devotion, and that loyalty and devotion and service that he had given him as chancellor. He expected that Becket would continue to promote royal policy as archbishop and be Henry's partner in administration of the realm, much as Theobald had been, but with greater enthusiasm and with less resistance.
And Becket really wasn't an outrageous choice. He was, after all, Archdeacon of Canterbury. He was, at that point, custodian of the lands of the Church of Canterbury. And he was the King's Chancellor. Now, the last may not seem to be an obvious qualification, becoming Archbishop. But in this period of time, it wasn't a disqualification. Both King Louis VII of France and the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa of Germany had elevated their chancellors to high episcopal office, and both continued afterwards to hold the office of chancellor. Service to the crown and service to the church, after all, was not supposed to be in conflict.
For historians of the medieval church, there is a nice irony about the movie's depiction of Becket's resistance to being named archbishop by Henry.
Which has a historical basis. According to William Fitzstephen, Thomas had to be persuaded to accept the office by Cardinal Henry of Pavia, the papal legate to Normandy.
Irony isn't that Thomas expressed reluctance, but why he was reluctant. medieval clerics in line to be promoted to bishop were expected to declare nolo episcopari.
How do you say, I really don't want to become a chairman of a history department?
I've coined one, nolo decanari.
I love that.
I do not want to be named a dean.
Yes, I like that.
So nolo episcopari means I don't wish to be made a bishop. And this was meant as an expression of humility. To be worthy of the office of bishop, a bishop-elect had to declare himself unworthy to assume so great a spiritual office. Beckett in the movie expresses his personal feelings of unworthiness, which is, of course, an assessment that Bishop Gilbert Folliot of London and the other English prelates of the time would have heartily seconded for real, but not because he fears that he actually will be unworthy of that office, and that it'll bring him into conflict with King Henry.
Yeah. And that turned out to be the case. As soon as Becket was consecrated archbishop, he seemed to become a completely new person. As chancellor, he had been accustomed to parading around in rich robes and cloaks. As archbishop, he wore a hair shirt under his episcopal robes to mortify the flesh. As chancellor, he lavished money on troubadours and courtiers. As archbishop, he gave money to the poor. Why he changed, and whether that change was genuine, is a matter of historical debate.
There are a number of ways to explain Thomas's change of heart. Cynically, one might say that Thomas, now that he had an independent power base, no longer felt that he had to dance to the king's tune. The Church of Canterbury was very powerful and very wealthy in its own right. In order to safeguard that power base, Thomas decided immediately that he was going to draw a firm line in the sand whenever the rights and privileges of the Church of Canterbury were threatened in any way, even by his former best friend, the king. Less cynically, Thomas's elevation to the office of archbishop had inspired an inner conversion that led him to embrace his new responsibility to protect the church with which God had entrusted him. Thomas had fallen seriously ill in the summer of 1161, and he first seems to have heard about his candidacy for the archiepiscopate while convalescing in the hospital of the Church of Saint-Gervais. Serious illness was the come-to-Jesus moment for
literally.
For many less than pious medieval people. King William Rufus, who was notoriously lax when it came to religion, decided to appoint the holiest man that he knew to be his Archbishop of Canterbury, St. Anselm of Bec, because he thought he was dying.
Unfortunately for all, William Rufus recovered and was stuck with Anselm as Archbishop, a situation that neither man enjoyed. I'd offer a third possibility for Thomas's transformation. It's possible that Thomas was the consummate actor. I'm not suggesting that he was insincere, inauthentic, but that he played whatever role he was assigned to the best of his ability. As a cleric in Archbishop Theobald's household, he fulfilled his function so well that the archbishop made him archdeacon. As royal chancellor, he was the king's man and unreservedly supported Henry's authority and claims. As archbishop, he was now the man of God and the church. In this new role, he supported the church's claims and authority as strongly as he had once supported the king's. As Archbishop of Canterbury, Becket was responsible for protecting the liberty of the church, which by then included free elections of bishops and abbots. I know this sounds ironic or even hypocritical, given the evidence for the almost universal disapproval by the bishops and higher clergy of Henry's choice of Thomas to succeed Theobald.
Perhaps ironic, but also instructive of what a free election meant in England in 1162. The investiture controversy in England had been resolved in 1107 by a compromise hammered out by Archbishop Anselm and King Henry I and accepted by Pope Paschal II.
It's sort of the dry run for the Concordat of Worms.
It basically is. Bishops would be freely elected by the clergy and invested with the symbols of their spiritual office by the bishop who consecrated them. But the king would continue to receive homage from newly elected bishops in return for the landed fiefs and temporal powers that they received from him. In essence, the English solution of 1107 recognized the episcopacy's two bodies. As pastors of the church, bishops received their authority and power from God via the church's clergy through apostolic succession. But as magnates of the realm and landholders of fiefs, they received their temporal powers and authority from the king.
The election of Thomas illustrates, I think, very well what a quote-unquote free election actually meant in 1162. Despite Thomas's continued role as Archdeacon of Canterbury, or given how unpopular archdeacons were, perhaps because of it, the cathedral chapter and monks of Canterbury, who were charged with freely electing the archbishop, needed a lot of persuasion. Once the prior of the abbey received the royal license to proceed with an election,
and that a royal license was needed in order for the clergy of Canterbury to have a quote-unquote free election, is itself highly revealing.
He called on the senior monks to discuss the king's nomination of Thomas. They, in turn, called in the royal justiciar, Richard de Lucy, to discuss with them the king's will. Richard de Lucy laid out pretty bluntly the benefits to the abbey and the see of having an archbishop who stood so high in the king's favor. The consequences of defying the king's will was at least implied. Even after the prior and senior monks recommended Thomas's candidacy to the other monks, there was vocal opposition to the choice. But it was a foregone conclusion that Thomas would be, quote-unquote, freely elected.
The importance of a bishop having royal favor cannot be overstressed. As Archbishop Becket was responsible for the physical welfare of the Church of Canterbury, which entailed safeguarding the church's property against encroachment by knights who held land from the abbey, one of Becket's first acts as archbishop was to demand that Roger de Clare, Earl of Hertford, and one of the most powerful laymen in England, perform homage to him for the castle of Tonbridge in Kent. It was a grand gesture, and although it proved unsuccessful, it made the point to the monks that the new archbishop would be zealous in guarding Canterbury's lands and claims to land.
One of Thomas's first clashes with King Henry II came over Thomas's excommunication of a Kentish baron for having driven out a priest from a parish church in the lands of the parish church, which were claimed by Canterbury. The baron claimed that he and not the archbishop had the right of presentation, that is, of choosing the parish priest. Thomas could have, and he should have, appealed to the king first, and Henry immediately protested that the customs of the realm prohibited that a tenant-in-chief be excommunicated without the consent of the king. Thomas replied that it was not the king's place to give orders to absolve or excommunicate anyone.
And that was going to be a point of contention. Financial demands by the crown were always a flashpoint in the relationship between medieval kings and bishops. As Archbishop Thomas protected his church by resisting the type of financial demands from the king that he, as chancellor, had enforced upon other prelates.
Yeah, notably scutage, which is the payment of cash in lieu of providing owed knight service.
Perhaps the most important duty that Thomas had as archbishop was to maintain the ancient rights and privileges of the See of Canterbury against the claims of the other bishops in England, in particular his old colleague from Theobald's household, Archbishop Roger de Pont-l'Évêque of York, who resisted acknowledging the primacy of Canterbury.
It's really kind of interesting. Old friendships and old rivalries just persist.
They really do.
Yeah, sort of like graduating together from an English public school.
Right.
Yes.
But none of this made Becket's break with the king inevitable. What did was the problem of criminis clergy.
In the previous episode, Richard and I discussed Henry II's imposition of royal authority over civil law, that is, the law of property and dispute settlement. But Henry II was also determined to reform the criminal law. He wanted to crack down not just on recalcitrant barons and lords who were abusing their prerogatives, but also on garden variety criminals. To that end, he set about reforming the royal approach to crime. he sent out roving commissions of judges called Ayers. These Ayers were specifically tasked with sweeping up criminals and trying their cases.
In 1166, Henry and his advisors regularized royal oversight of criminal law at the Assize of Clarendon, quote, on the advice of all his barons, and with the goal of preserving peace and maintaining justice, King Henry ordained that inquiries be made throughout each county and each hundred by 12 of the more lawful men of the hundred and by 4 of the more lawful men of each vill. These men shall swear an oath to tell the truth concerning whether in their hundred or in their vill there is any man cited or charged as a robber, murderer, or thief, or whether there is anyone who has abetted any robber, murderer, or thief
in the time since the Lord King's coronation.
And if a robber, murderer, or thief, or the receivers of them, shall be arrested by means of the aforesaid oath at a time when the royal justices are not due to appear any time soon into the county where the arrests have been made, let the sheriff send word by some knowledgeable man to one of the nearer justices that such criminals have been arrested, and the justices shall send back to the sheriff word of where they wish to have the men brought before them, and the sheriff shall bring them before the justices,
and they shall also bring with them from the hundred in the vill in which the arrests were made
2 lawful men to carry the record of the county and hundred as to why the men were arrested, and let the sheriffs who have arrested these criminals bring them before the justices without requiring any other summons than the one they shall receive from the justice. In other words, royal common law was now to embrace criminal as well as civil law.
These new juries of presentment are often held up as the origins of our grand juries, and in a sense they were, since they were responsible for making criminal indictments. But medieval juries did so on the basis of what they personally knew about the offenses. Their primary function was as witnesses, which is why wrong decisions were treated as perjury.
Right. Henry II went after a group of people whom he considered to be threats to public order because they tended to escape royal jurisdiction. This class of troublemakers were, strangely enough, clergymen or clerks, to use the contemporary term.
That doesn't mean that they were necessarily priests. There were many grades in the clerical hierarchy, and men could work their way slowly up these grades while still living much like laymen. Those in lower orders, like doorkeepers, acolytes, exorcists, and readers, there are 7 grades, were even allowed to marry. Technically, these guys are churchmen, but they aren't really living very church-oriented lives. Some of them were really poor, scraping by on meager salaries or none at all. So it's not surprising that a few clearly supplemented their earnings by recourse to crime. And some, even in the higher orders of deacon and priest, were just flat-out criminals. Before the Norman Conquest, a criminus clerk, as these clerical criminals were called, would just have been tried for his crimes in a hundred or shire court like anybody else. But William the Conqueror had brought in a parallel court system in England that was run by the church. These church courts had jurisdiction over certain cases that involved correction of sinful behavior.
As I mentioned in a previous episode, this included adultery. Once marriage became a Catholic sacrament, marital disputes, including accusations of adultery, were heard in these ecclesiastical canon law courts. But canon law courts also claimed jurisdiction not only over certain kinds of offenses, but also over certain types of people, namely anyone in clerical orders, even the minor clerical orders. Under William the Conqueror and his sons, William Rufus and Henry I, the secular courts and the church courts had worked out a modus vivendi by which clerics accused of really serious crimes would first be stripped of their clerical status in the church court, in the canon law court, and then handed over to the royal courts for further punishment.
The reason for this was that church courts were forbidden by canon law to impose penalties that involved the shedding of blood. So, no executions or mutilations. If you wanted those, you had to go to the royal court.
Yes. but this was all a matter of custom. There weren't any hard and fast written rules about when exactly the church courts were obligated to cough up particular criminis clerks. But in the first half of the 12th century, the Catholic Church had evolved into what some historians like to call a papal monarchy.
The church was conceived of as a universal state with both a heavenly and a temporal component,
in which all clergy, regardless of where they were stationed, were solely under the jurisdiction of the church. As with the baronage, the claims of the church vis-a-vis the authority of the crown went unchallenged during the civil war between King Stephen and the Empress Matilda because the royal authority couldn't challenge it.
Henry II was determined to restore the good legal customs of his grandfather, King Henry I, and this included reestablishing royal authority over criminis clerics. Several big clerical scandals helped push him in this direction, and I'll just tell you about one of them.
This is a good one.
It is. In 1163, a canon of Bedford named Philip de Blois was accused of murdering a knight. He was brought before the archbishop's court and purged himself of the crime. That is, he swore an oath that he was innocent, and the oath was accepted. That's all it took in the church court to get off scot-free. Later, a royal judge tried to reopen the case because apparently there were ample grounds to doubt the sincerity of Philip's oath. Philip insulted the judge before witnesses. This was, if anything, a more serious crime in the king's eyes than the alleged murder. But once again, he was hauled up before the archbishop's court, and this time he was convicted of insulting the judge, but he was again acquitted of the murder. He was sentenced to the loss of revenues from his ecclesiastical office for 2 years with the money distributed to the poor, and a public whipping in the presence of the judge he insulted. If he had been found guilty in a royal court, he would have faced execution or mutilation. Henry was utterly fed up with clerks being able, literally, to get away with murder.
As Jenny said, that was only one of several high-profile cases of criminis clerics that came to the king's attention. William Fitzstephen, in a biography meant to praise Becket, relates how the archbishop refused to turn over to the royal courts a clerk of Worcester who had killed the father of a girl that he was attempting to rape. Becket placed the murderer and rapist into the archbishop's prison so that the royal authorities could not take custody of him. What especially pissed off Henry II was that the man who protected this murderous cleric from royal justice and presided over the trial of Philip de Blois was the man whom he had made archbishop in order to support his claims of royal authority.
By elevating Thomas to be primate, Henry thought he was finally going to have an archbishop he could really deal with, who would really support him, who would be essentially his man. After all, Thomas owed everything to the king.
But when Henry went after criminis clerks, the archbishop pushed back.
W. L. Warren, whose 1973 biography of King Henry II for Yale's English Monarch series is still, in my assessment, the standard biography of that king. Warren pointed out that Becket's insistence on the church's sole jurisdiction over criminis clerks, quote, called into question the whole of Archbishop Theobald's modus vivendi with the state, and that drove the king to an equally dogmatic stand on the royal prerogative, end quote.
And those royal prerogatives over the English church were spelled out in detail in a document known as the Constitutions of Clarendon. The Constitutions of Clarendon were the record of a royal assize, that is, a meeting of the king with his lay and ecclesiastical advisors held at the Royal Hunting Lodge at Clarendon in 1164. The Constitutions of Clarendon obliged the church to hand criminis clerks over to be tried by the royal courts.
But it went even further than that. It also deals with the other key points of dispute between the king and the English church. It prohibited archbishops and bishops from excommunicating tenants-in-chief without first receiving the approval of the king, and from leaving, even leaving the kingdom or appealing to the papacy without first again getting permission of the king. Disputes over ecclesiastical property were to be resolved like all other land disputes in a royal court, and church-held lands were to owe the same royal dues as lands held by the laity. The Constitutions of Clarendon is presented as a restoration of the good customs and royal privileges practiced under King Henry I, and that probably is true, but times had changed, and the constitutions were a response not only to the clergy's claim to be solely responsible for disciplining itself, but to the papacy's claims to be the supreme head of a universal church. In essence, it was the expression of King Henry II's notion that he was supreme over the church in his kingdom, and his insistence that the clergy of his kingdom, from doorkeeper all the way up to archbishop, were his subjects.
Becket was summoned before the royal presence and forced, probably literally under the threat of violence, to accept this renunciation of the church's rights of jurisdiction. But after accepting the constitutions and making all the other bishops accept them, Becket then changed his mind and decided to take a stand.
And that must have gone over really big with Bishop Gilbert Folliot and the other English bishops, they didn't want him to be archbishop in the first place.
Oh, this was really a disaster. So he renounces the constitutions of Clarendon.
After forcing everybody else to accept them.
So they were enraged. He had made them go against their consciences because they didn't think that these provisions were a good idea. But he was then going back on his word, trying to have it both ways. So Thomas lost a lot of episcopal support right there. There was an uneasy truce with the king at this point, but Thomas and Henry could not stop provoking each other. Little disputes over property got magnified out of all proportion. Finally, the king seems to have reached a breaking point, and he decided to bring Becket down for good. He accused him of financial improprieties while chancellor and summoned him to appear before him at Northampton. Apparently, a very large sum of money that the king had given to Thomas as chancellor, £30,000.
Which is about the annual revenues you could expect from all of England.
It's a huge amount of money, could not be accounted for. Nobody knows the truth of what happened with this money. Had it been a gift, and was it thus unfair to be asking for an accounting now? Or was Thomas being truthful when he claimed that he had spent all of the money on the king's affairs? We will never know, and it's very likely that the whole affair was a put-up job. This is the sort of thing that the Angevin kings did. But the charge was serious enough that the archbishop felt he had no option but to flee. He didn't want to be treated publicly like a criminal clerk. So he escaped from Northampton with a few followers, and after a harrowing cross-country journey of 3 weeks, he finally made it to the port of Sandwich, which was under Canterbury's control, and he embarked for exile on the continent.
Which, I might point out, violated the constitutions of Clarendon.
It did.
Becket actually violated the constitutions twice. First, by appealing to the papacy the judgment of the bishops against him in the civil case of contempt of court, and then by leaving the kingdom without the king's permission. If Thomas's fellow bishops were upset, King Henry II was royally pissed. He sent a letter to King Louis VII of France urging him not to allow Becket to remain in his realm. It's a wonderful letter, and it gives you a sense of the character, the personality of Henry II. Quote, "Know that Thomas, who was Archbishop of Canterbury," and the past tense, "who was Archbishop of Canterbury."
It's very significant.
Yeah. Has been publicly adjudged in my court by full council of the barons of my realm to be a wicked and perjured traitor to me, and under the manifest name of traitor has wickedly departed. Wherefore, I earnestly beg you not to permit a man guilty of such infamous crimes and treasons or his men to remain in your kingdom. Rather, if it pleases you, help me to take vengeance on my great enemy for this affront and to seek my honor, even as you would wish me to do for you if you were placed into this situation.
But Louis VII wasn't moved. Thomas was too valuable a pawn against a king who, as Duke of Normandy and Aquitaine and Count of Anjou, was also an overmighty subject. So he wasn't going to throw that away.
Yeah.
It would be 6 years before Thomas returned to England. 6 years of fruitless negotiations involving not just Henry II and Thomas, but also the King of France and Pope Alexander III, not to mention almost every other bishop and secular ruler in Western Europe.
It had to be really frustrating. You're dealing with two guys who are not going to back down, and a bunch of people around them who want them to just simply get over this.
This would have been on the crawl on CNN every single day for 6 years.
Yeah.
One gets the sense that Pope Alexander III regarded Becket as an unwelcome problem that he wished would simply go away. When Becket appeared before the Pope, he carried with him a copy of the Constitutions of Clarendon. Spreading the offending document in front of him, Thomas melodramatically assumed blame for them. He had failed in his duty as Archbishop to protect the liberty of the Church. He had showed himself unworthy to hold the high office, an office he obtained, he confessed, through an uncanonical and illegitimate procedure. Telling the Pope that he was unequal to the burden, he resigned the archbishopric into the hands of the Pope.
Now, Alexander III, this is all theater, right?
It really is very performative.
It really is. Alexander III had little recourse but to reappoint Becket, which wiped out any doubt about his legitimacy to be archbishop.
Comes right from the Pope.
It comes right from the Pope. Because how is Alexander III going to say, oh, the Constitutions of Clarendon are fine? That he can't. I mean, he's stuck with this. So he has to support Becket, and whether he wants to or not.
But, as I said, Becket presented a real political problem for Alexander III.
The Pope was currently engaged in an existential struggle with the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa of Germany and the man he had appointed as Pope, anti-Pope. So here we have Alexander III fighting with the Emperor of Germany, needing the support of the other kings, not wanting to alienate King Henry II or alienate King Louis VII. So what Pope Alexander's response was to try as best he could to reconcile all the parties. The problem was that neither Henry nor Thomas was willing to admit that he was wrong or submit to the other. In the case of both of this, it's a matter of pride, and they're not going to humble themselves or humiliate themselves. Louis VII, meanwhile, was willing to continue to pay for Thomas's upkeep and give him protection, largely to underscore his own piety in contrast to Henry II.
We can get a sense of how King Louis VII exploited Thomas's exile from a contemporary song in Rama Sonat Gemitus.
The sound of weeping is heard in Rama. The Rachel of England is in tears. A new King Herod has visited upon her this ignominy. Behold, the firstborn of the realm, Canterbury's own Joseph now, has been sold into slavery and forced to inhabit the Egypt of France.
Wow. That's a pretty powerful statement.
It's a pretty powerful statement.
So the stalemate was broken by new points of contention between Henry II and Thomas. This had to do directly with Henry's dynastic plans. Henry wanted his oldest son, also called Henry, to be crowned King of England even while he himself was still alive. This would be a kind of insurance policy that he would succeed peacefully when the time came. Remember, the successions of all the other English kings since the Norman conquest had been dicey affairs. Think of Henry I sprinting to Winchester to get the royal treasury after his brother is killed in the hunting accident.
Accidental hunting accident.
Well, yeah, we can debate that.
Yes.
Or Stephen having to hurry across the channel to do likewise. Henry II wanted his son to have an easier path to the throne, and in order to get his son crowned, he needed the Archbishop of Canterbury, or at least custom required that the Archbishop of Canterbury consecrate the kings of England. You really wanted the Archbishop of Canterbury to do it if you possibly could make it happen, because that was going to look the best. Becket refused to do it. There was still stuff he wanted to straighten out with the king before he was willing to help him out in this way. But if you couldn't settle with the Archbishop of Canterbury, there was also another archbishop in England, the Archbishop of York. You could get the Archbishop of York to do it.
This is exactly what William the Conqueror had done because of doubts to the legitimacy of the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Stigand. To remove any doubt that such a move was kosher, sorry, couldn't resist, Henry II obtained approval from Pope Alexander III, and that approval was probably given either in gratitude, or a little bit more cynically, as payment for Henry II's recent formal recognition of the Pope as being the Pope.
So, on June 14th, 1170, Prince Henry was crowned in Westminster Abbey by the Archbishop of York. After that, he was usually referred to as Henry the Young King. Becket was devastated. This was a blow at one of Canterbury's most cherished prerogatives, the right to consecrate the king. But shortly after this, the king and the archbishop met in France and made up their quarrel, though they may not have understood each other completely. Becket thought the king was giving him permission to excommunicate the bishops who had been involved in what Becket considered to be the illegal consecration of the prince. Henry definitely did not think the same thing. At any rate, it seemed like peace at the time. In the meantime, letters arrived from the Pope imposing sentence on the bishops who had helped in the consecration. Becket forwarded them on to England. As he prepared to cross the channel himself, Becket excommunicated the Archbishop of York and the bishops of London and Salisbury.
Despite Henry II's promise of peace, the situation remained tense. In theory, the king and archbishop had reconciled. Henry II had renounced the privileges claimed in the constitutions of Clarendon and had agreed, after extended negotiations, to the restoration of all the lands and property that the crown had confiscated from Thomas and those who followed him into exile. Becket, for his part, promised loyalty to the king and agreed to reconsecrate young Henry as king, thus saving both the dignity of Canterbury and confirming the legitimacy of the first coronation. But King Henry II was giving mixed signals. He refused to release any of the revenues of the see until Thomas physically returned to Canterbury. Becket could do nothing but watch as the man whom the king had appointed custodian of the lands of Canterbury stripped it of its resources. Penniless, Becket, awaiting transit to England in Rouen, was besieged by his creditors. The Archbishop of Rouen came to his rescue, providing him sufficient funds to pay off his debts and to outfit his entourage for a return suitable to his rank. Opposition to Becket's return was widespread. This included not only the bishops and clerics whom Becket had excommunicated, but a lot of landowners who now held the lands that the king had confiscated from Becket's followers. As Frank Ballo pointed out, Becket's return was the harbinger of a territorial counter-revolution in Kent. Those who supported the king would lose the property they held from the see, while those who had been dispossessed would regain theirs. Most threatening, however, was while Henry II had given verbal promises and protestations of goodwill, he had withheld the kiss of peace, and that was ominous to say the least. Becket did not help his situation by repeating his excommunication of the three bishops and those who had plundered his see in his absence, this time in his new capacity as papal legate. Upon arriving in England, Becket met with royal officials who pleaded the case of the excommunicated prelates.
Becket said that he would grant the Archbishop of York and the Bishops of London and Salisbury conditional absolution if they showed genuine repentance, promised satisfaction, and took an oath to obey the commands of the Pope as laid out in the papal letters that he carried, and which they hadn't seen. They refused, citing the constitutions of Clarendon's prohibition about contacting the Pope without royal permission. So Thomas let the excommunication stand. As Becket made his triumphant return to Canterbury, three very unhappy bishops crossed the Channel in the other direction to seek redress from the king in Normandy. They found Henry II at his court at Burrus, near Bayeux, where he planned to hold his Christmas court. The bishops knew the king, maybe not as well as Becket did, but well enough to press the right buttons. Becket was persecuting them, they complained, for the love they had shown Henry in consecrating his son King of England as he had ordered them to do. Not only had Becket excommunicated them, he now threatened to depose the young king. Henry II snapped, which brings us to the famous outburst that had exasperated Henry II was supposed to have shouted to his courtiers.
Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest? A priest who mocks me. Are there no men left in England?
I love the scene, and I love the way that Peter O'Toole overacts in the scene, because that's how Henry II's described. But, as I mentioned in the previous episode, there really is no contemporary support for Henry having said, "Will no one rid me of this turbulent priest?" But it's clear that he did say something along those lines. Becket's friend and cleric, the very well-informed John of Salisbury, heard that Henry had declared, quote, with tears, that the archbishop would take from him both body and soul, and that they were all traitors who would not summon up the zeal and loyalty to rid him of the harassment of one man, end quote. Now, a bit more verbose than the pithy.
Will no one rid me of this turbulent priest?
But essentially, it means the same thing.
So four knights of the king's household, Reginald Fitzurse, Hugh de Morville, Richard LeBret, and William de Tracy, who Cat Tracy told me was her ancestor.
Cool.
Which, I don't know if I'd claim my ancestry to a murderer of the saint, but, you know, hell. I could trace my ancestry all the way back to Brooklyn. Anyway.
These four knights took the king's outburst as a command, or at least as an opportunity to win even greater royal favor. They crossed the Channel and rode off to Canterbury to create a martyr.
No, they probably didn't intend to kill Becket, but rather to arrest him and bring him before the king. But when he resisted their attempts to coerce him, they cut him down right in his cathedral.
I agree with Jenny that the knights probably intended to take Becket into custody, but that the confrontation got out of hand. It didn't help matters that three of these four knights owed Becket for past favors. Thomas's martyrdom was fueled by anger arising from feelings of betrayal. If Henry II felt aggrieved by Thomas's ingratitude, so now did Thomas. Three of the knights had been Becket's vassals when he had been chancellor, and one, Hugh de Morville, had remained in Thomas's service after he became archbishop. That men who had once pledged him loyalty were now accusing him of treason rankled the archbishop. Becket singled out Reginald Fitzurse, the leader of the group, and charged him with ingratitude, reminding him that he owed his place in the king's court to Thomas's recommendation.
When the frightened monks came out of hiding, they found the body of the archbishop lying before the altar. When they stripped the body, they discovered a hair shirt crawling with vermin under the dead bishop's expensive vestments.
I'll add Ellen's commentary on that. Ew.
This clinched it. Overnight, Becket went from first-class troublemaker to saint. King Henry tried in vain to argue that he hadn't ordered the knights to kill Becket, but everyone basically accepted his ultimate responsibility for the deed.
Even he did. which may explain why the four knights were never tried or convicted of murder. Rather, they ended up seeking absolution from the Pope, who for their penance sent them on crusade.
Reports of miracles at Canterbury started almost immediately, and on February 21st, 1173, less than 3 years after Thomas's death, he was canonized by Pope Alexander III.
Henry II also sought absolution from the Pope. Meeting with a papal legation in northern France, Henry admitted indirect responsibility for the death of the archbishop, but he swore an oath on the Gospels that he had neither ordered nor desired Thomas's death. For Henry's penance, he agreed to go on crusade for 3 years to restore all the lands and property to all clerks and laity who had been despoiled because of their support of Thomas, and to fast and give alms. The constitutions of Clarendon were now as dead as Becket. Through his death, Becket had won against the king, game, set, and match. Henry II and his successors up until King Henry VIII accepted the principle that clergy remained exempt from royal jurisdiction. In England, this was called benefit of clergy, which survived in an attenuated form until abolished by Parliament in 1827. Before then, however, King Henry VIII had limited benefit of clergy to minor crimes, reserving murder, rape, poisoning, petty treason, sacrilege, witchcraft, theft, and pickpocketing to be adjudicated in the king's courts.
I love the fact that witchcraft and pickpocketing belong together on that list.
I know. Somehow it seems that you're merging together things that seem really serious with, eh?
Yeah, well, yeah. Witchcraft seemed like a bigger deal to them than it does to us.
Yeah, pickpocketing.
And pickpocketing too.
Yeah, really.
So in 1174, King Henry II was facing a serious revolt by his eldest son, abetted by his other sons, his wife Eleanor of Aquitaine, and the King of the Scots. With this war going badly, Henry II undertook to make his final amends to the martyr and saint. He went on pilgrimage to Canterbury, where he confessed to being the unwitting cause of the death of the saint. And removing his cloak, he knelt down to be flogged by the clergy in attendance. And this is actually the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, it is.
In the beginning of the movie. He then promised to build a monastery in honor of St. Thomas.
This was an act of political theater. By accepting the public humiliation of a flogging, Henry was acknowledging his guilt and demonstrating his remorse for his complicity, however unintended, in the martyrdom of the saint.
Given that he was fighting for his crown at this point, it makes sense that he would want to remove the taint of the death of Becket from himself.
He wanted a reset.
And he got it.
He did.
You know, one of the interesting things about this that I learned afterwards is that although Becket won in terms of the principles, Becket's enemies all prospered afterwards, and Becket's friends and supporters never got the great ecclesiastical preferments, with the exception of John of Salisbury, that they all wanted.
And John of Salisbury's episcopal appointment is not in England.
Exactly. Exactly. The popularity of St. Thomas surged in the following centuries. Canterbury became the go-to place for pilgrimages in England. The most famous literary work arising from the martyrdom of Thomas Becket is about one of those pilgrimages. It's Geoffrey Chaucer's late 14th century, The Canterbury Tales. The literary conceit in this work, the framing device, is that you have a group of pilgrims who all want to go to Canterbury to visit the shrine of St. Thomas Becket. Becket had become an overnight sensation when he was martyred in 1170, and his tomb was the most popular domestic pilgrimage destination in England, even two centuries later. So you have 29 pilgrims from all walks of life, and they all happen to gather at an inn in Southwark, across the river from London, on the south bank of the Thames.
There's some grumbling among these ill-assorted guests until the innkeeper proposes a wager. They will all go on pilgrimage together, including the innkeeper himself, so that makes 30 pilgrims, and along the way, each pilgrim will tell two tales on the outward journey and two tales on the way back. And the one who everybody agrees tells the best tale will win a free dinner at the expense of all the rest. Unfortunately, Chaucer never followed through completely on this scheme. If you do the math, we should have 120 stories, but we only have 24, not even one for each pilgrim, let alone four for each pilgrim. But we should be very grateful for the ones we have. The reason is that Chaucer uses his pilgrims as a vehicle for social commentary on English men and women from all social classes and walks of life. So that's fantastic for historians. We get a great cross-section of English social life. The social status of the pilgrims is reflected very well in the tales they choose to tell. Their characters of very high status, like the knight, tell very elevated, very refined tales about courtly adventures and chivalry. The characters of very low social status, like the miller and the reeve, tell quite earthy stories with salty language that you might not want to read aloud in mixed company.
But you know, what unites them all is their veneration for St. Thomas and their belief that if they go on pilgrimage to the shrine in Canterbury, that Thomas will grant them their prayers.
That's right.
Chaucer used a pilgrimage to the shrine of St. Thomas as a device to tell a variety of stories representing not only a variety of literary genres, but the full range of England's social classes. What made this an effective device is that such pilgrimages were a reality in the late 14th century. The martyrdom of Thomas Becket was a watershed in the history of church-state relations in medieval England, and the cult of St. Thomas was vitally important to the self-confidence of the English church. Here was a case where the church had stood up to the secular power and won. The king had had to back off, and while relationship between church and state was by no means trouble-free, the church did preserve more legal autonomy than King Henry II had wanted, to the degree that separate church courts and benefit of clergy survived well past the Middle Ages. Given that, it isn't surprising that another royal Henry, Henry VIII, should have viewed Becket and his cult as an obstacle to restoring what he saw as the proper relationship between the crown and the English church. It's well known that Henry VIII suppressed the monasteries, including Christ Church Canterbury. What is less well known is that Henry VIII harbored particular animus against one English saint, Thomas Becket. In 1536, Henry VIII abolished the feast of Becket's translation, which is on July 7th. In the following year, he ordered the image of St. Thomas's martyrdom removed from the seal of the city of Canterbury. In 1538, Becket's shrine at Canterbury was dismantled and its treasures carted away in 26 wagons. Becket's bones were either burnt, which is what the Pope had been told, or reburied in an unmarked grave. Soon after, King Henry VIII and his chancellor, Thomas Cromwell, issued a joint proclamation that completed the desanctification of Becket. Henry VIII termed in the document a goodly and a Catholic prince, quote, lawfully sovereign chief and supreme head on earth immediately after Christ of the Church of England, decries the usurped authority claimed by Thomas Becket, and labels Becket a rebel and traitor to his prince. Consequently, Henry VIII decreed, quote, Thomas Becket shall not be esteemed, named, reputed, nor called a saint, and his images and pictures through the whole realm shall be put down and avoided out of all churches, chapels, and other places. The days used to be festival in his name shall not be observed, nor the services, offices, antiphons, collects, and prayers in his name read, but erased and put out of all the books. End quote. Not only was Becket's shrine at Canterbury demolished, but following the proclamation, so were images and pictures of him throughout England. The thoroughness of the suppression of Becket's cult is physically reflected in the surviving missals from Henry VIII's reign. Dr. Aura Masurek Zanetti discovered that in every one of the surviving 200 missals, the services commemorating Becket had been erased, crossed out, or covered with a dye to make them illegible. But Henry VIII was no more successful in erasing the memory of Thomas Becket than he was in erasing the memory of the other Thomas whom he helped to make a saint, Thomas More. But we are running out of time as usual, and I would like to chat with Jenny at least a little bit about Thomas Beckett in the movies, or in this case, movie. The movie is, of course, Beckett, directed by Peter Glenville and starring Richard Burton, Peter O'Toole, and John Gielgud. Beckett did okay financially, ranking 15th in box office receipts for films released in 1964. It did better than okay with the critics. After winning the Golden Globes for Best Picture, it garnered 12 Academy Award nominations, including for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, both Burton and O'Toole got nods, and Best Supporting Actor for John Gielgud. It ended up only winning one Oscar, and that was for Edward Anhalt's adaptation of Jean Anouilh's 1959 stage play Beckett. Jenny, I don't know about you, but I've always found it interesting that a movie about England's most famous martyr is based upon a play written by a Frenchman.
And there's an interesting story with this play. Supposedly, Jean Anouilh went on a house party over the weekend to a place where he found a book about Thomas Beckett on the shelf, and he sort of picked it up and started to read it. And he became very fascinated with the story of Beckett, and he wrote this play. But the play isn't really, if it comes right down to it, about the 12th century at all.
Yeah.
It's about recent French history.
How so?
Well, the play casts Thomas Beckett as a Saxon.
So
mentioned this in the first episode. And so there is a dynamic in the movie and the play in which Beckett is essentially a collaborator. The word collaborator is actually even used in the script. So he is cooperating with the Norman oppressor. And so there's even a character, a completely invented character, in the play and the movie, the Saxon attendant who helps Beckett out with his personal affairs. He chides Beckett for having gone over to the enemy, essentially. Mm. And this attendant helps Beckett, as Archbishop, to rediscover his inner Saxon, so to speak. And he begins to see that he needs to stand up to Norman oppression. Now, this dynamic has nothing to do with what was really going on in Beckett's actual life, because, as we mentioned last time,
he's not a Saxon.
Not a Saxon. He's a Norman.
And the little tidbit I picked up since our last episode, while Beckett was not a Saxon, one of the knights who murdered him was, or at least he was of mixed heritage. William de Tracy's great-great-grandmother was Godewful, sister of King Edward the Confessor, and his grandmother was Githa, daughter of an East Anglian Anglo-Danish noble named Osgood Clapa.
But this is really all about collaboration in France with the Vichy regime in World War II.
Interesting.
How would you compare Anouilh's Beckett to T.S. Eliot's 1935 play about Thomas's martyrdom, Murder in the Cathedral?
It's completely different. So the movie, first of all, there's a movie of the play by Eliot.
Which you actually saw in school, I saw on the web.
Yeah, it was shown to me in high school. As I think I've mentioned, I went to a rather unusual high school.
Yeah, fourth grade.
Right. So anyway, so we watched it as part of my medieval England history course that I took in high school. And it's very stagey. Very stylized. So the Beckett film that's based on the Anouilh play is in a very naturalistic style.
And it's cinematic.
It is very cinematic.
But it's an epic.
It is an epic. But the Eliot play is instead really, first of all, it's in verse. And it's really an exploration of the interior life of Beckett. So it doesn't focus, for example, on a friendship between the king and the archbishop the way you see in the Beckett film.
Yeah, and in fact, in the Beckett film, Henry II and Beckett are presented as buddies. They're good friends. They go hunting together. Beckett does everything with Henry II except share in his sexual escapades.
However, they work that into the film because in the film, Beckett has a mistress who was played by the unbelievable Sean Phillips, who later becomes Livia on I, Claudius.
Oh, really? I love that.
Yes, right. So she plays Beckett's mistress, and at one point, Henry actually comes along and says, "I'll have her, please."
Ah.
And then the Sean Phillips character, who, by the way, is Welsh, which is a wonderful little added bonus there. So Sean Phillips says to Beckett, will you take me back afterwards? And he says, no, I won't. Because he knows that to take her back after she's been with the king is just not going to happen. That doesn't work. And so this is an instance in which, a little bit like the cloak story that you talked about last time, the king is asserting his power over Beckett. So this is not a mutual relationship. So he could even take Beckett's woman. Now, there's no evidence of the actual Beckett having a mistress.
Would an archdeacon have had a mistress?
Possibly. I mean, if you think about it, you know, Roger of Salisbury, who's a bishop earlier in the 12th century, had a wife.
That's true.
So it wouldn't have been impossible to imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, this sort of thing did happen and was discussed, but we don't have any reference to it. And given as many enemies as Beckett had,
you would have thought,
one would think that if he did have any sort of publicly acknowledged mistress, we would know.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
But what I think the movie got right about the relationship between Beckett and Henry II is that Henry II really did feel a sense of personal betrayal.
And it may not be a betrayal because of friendship. It's a betrayal for what the reasons that he wrote to Louis VII. This is the man I made. This was my man. And what did he do? He betrayed me. He committed treason against me. And that is unforgivable. It's one thing to have somebody who was like Theobald, whom he inherited, but to raise up Beckett, who really was socially a nobody, to make him the most powerful churchman in England, and then to have him turn on him.
I think that both the character in the film and the character in history, both from their own perspective, had grievances that could justify the ferocity with which this conflict was pursued.
The movie gives only the slightest nod to the issue that really divided Henry II and Beckett, the problem of criminis clerics.
It does, because it really wants to get to the human drama as much as possible. And discussing the different provisions of the constitutions of Clarendon would not have made for wonderful cinema.
But fortunately, it makes for a fascinating podcast. But all good things must come to an end, even a podcast about the constitutions of Clarendon. But before we go, I'm going to play another short clip. Jenny, I know that you're not a fan of T.S. Eliot or of his play, Murder in the Cathedral, but I ran across a performance of that play that is quite simply stunning.
Good evening. This new series of Trim Jeans Theatre presents will enable you to enjoy the poetry of T.S. Eliot whilst losing unsightly tummy bulge. Gene.
Well, yes, and the inches stay off. Mark?
Terrific. Thrilled at Thomas and Beckett's Kierkegaardian moment of choice, whilst making your physique tighter, firmer, neater.
I am here, no traitor to the king.
Absolve all those you have excommunicated.
Resign those powers you have abrogated. Renew the obedience you have violated.
Lose inches off your hips, thighs, buttocks, and abdomen.
Richard, I thought I was a Monty Python nerd. I had never heard this before. Thank you for this. And notice, they call him Thomas A. Beckett.
Well, the podcast is called Tis But a Scratch. Jenny, it was great having you back as a co-host on the podcast, and I hope you'll come back to do an episode with me on the Norman Conquest. It's a subject that I know that we both are really interested in.
I'm excited for that one.
Yeah. And until then, bye for now.
Bye-bye.